You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Hill reporting that Daryl Issa, if he hadn't entered it into the federal record where it's constitutionally protected by outing wiretaps in an ongoing criminal investigation by the Department of Justice, Daryl Issa, once a small-time crook, is now a big-time crook. And it's not inconceivable he could still be charged with a felony. That would be perfectly, beautifully ironic, wouldn't it? Ireland, big news this week. Today, actually, this came out. And this is one of those stories where it'll probably, you know, I think this should be a huge, big deal, right? I mean, the key to democracy is the vote. And Ireland is scrapping their voting machines. But you won't see this covered or hear this covered on most of the media in the United States because, you know, it's corporate machines and it's corporate media and it's our corporate vote now. And, well, let me devolve into a little bit of rant on this. Ireland decided this week to scrap their voting machines, literally. They're selling them for scrap metal because they found they were too unreliable and too easy to hack. They'd only used them once back in 2002, but that was enough. Unfortunately, America hasn't learned as quickly as the Irish. It used to be in America that exit polls were the gold standard to determine if there were shenanigans in an election. You know, for over a century, we used exit polls. And we got very, very good at it. The exit polls almost never deviated by more than a few tenths of a point from the actual electoral outcome. And when they did, I mean, this is how they busted, you know, Jim Crow fraud down in the South. Such a sure sign that exit polls were used successfully to expose and then overturn fraudulent elections was found in Ukraine, Serbia, and Georgia, the country of Georgia. In all three countries, the exit polls were not the same as the election outcomes, and the international community yelled and screamed, and the elections got overturned. Polling companies were really good at this, and they had great success in the election of 1998, when voting machines only recorded 7% of the national vote here in the United States. But in the elections of 2000 and 2002, something odd began to happen. It was called redshift, because in certain states where there were a lot of voting machines being used, Republican candidates did better in the vote that the machines reported than in the exit polls. In the election of 2004, New York, Pennsylvania, Florida, and Ohio led the charge with a redshift toward George W. Bush of 276,000 votes in New York. This is more votes that the machines recorded than the exit polls showed. 276,000 votes in New York, 228,000 in Florida, 190,000 in Pennsylvania, 169,000 votes in Ohio. It had started 2 years earlier, in 2002, when voting machines started to pop up all across the United States. Why? Because George Bush had signed this law called HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, in 2002, which gave billions of our taxpayer dollars to the states so they could buy these machines from private corporations like Diebold and ES&S, these largely Republican-organized private for-profit corporations. That was the high water point of the privatization of our vote. For 200 years, two centuries, our vote was counted by volunteers and government workers overseen by representatives of the political parties. I used to watch this as a little kid. My mom was a volunteer at the polls in Lansing. And she would check people's names when they came in and look at their signatures and help count the vote. And then they'd, you know, call in, report the vote. That all changed between 2000 and 2004. In just those 4 years, we went from 7% to now over 90% of our vote being recorded or counted in secret on corporate machines. And those corporations now tell us who won our elections. Why is it secret? Because the voting machine companies say they have copyright and trademark rights to keep their software and hardware secret from us. And so that redshift has continued, in some cases accelerated, in every election since 2002 to this day. In fact, expect to see it this November if any of the exit polling companies will release their raw data, something most stopped doing when their numbers went screwy in 2004. Back in 2004, Tina Brown had a TV show called Topic A with Tina Brown on CNBC. And one day she was off and she had Howard Dean filling in for her. Dean had Bev Harris of blackboxvoting.org on the show. And together, in fewer than 90 seconds, they hacked into a Diebold voting machine system and changed the results of an election in a way that couldn't be traced. Here is a clip from that. We've edited it to take out the pauses between words while Bev Harris is doing things on this machine. But in 90 seconds, this is 90 seconds compressed down to about 50. In 90 seconds, Howard Dean and Bev Harris on live national television hacked a Diebold voting machine. Here it goes.
Bev sat me down, and in a few short seconds, I was amazed at what I could do.
All right, Bev, show me how to do this.
Go to My Computer and just click that. Go to Local Disk C. Go to GEMS, which is the name of the Diebold program. You're going to go to Local DB, which stands for Local Database. That's where they keep the votes. And by the way, this has been out on the Internet for ages now. Go to Central Tabulator Votes, which is the database we just looked at. And then go to the sum of the candidates, which is that table. You see we have 800 votes here for you and 400 for Lex Luthor. Let's just flip those. We'll make that 400, and we'll give 100 votes to Tiger. Let's just see what happened here. We'll go back into GEMS the legitimate way. You're the county supervisor. You're checking on the progress of your election. And as you can see now, Howard Dean only has 500 votes. Lex Luthor has 900, and Tiger Woods has 100 votes. We just edited the election. It took us 90 seconds.
Right there on national TV. You would think that would be a big story. A few months later, on March 7th, 2005, John Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, told a group of Seattle guests at a March 7th lunch for Representative Adam Smith, according to reporter Joel Connolly in an article in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, quote, this is Teresa Hines Kerry saying, quote, two brothers own 80% of the voting machines used in the United States. Connolly said that Hines Kerry added that it is, quote, very easy to hack into the mother machines, end quote, which is what you just heard Bev Harrison and Howard Dean doing, is they were hacking the central tabulator machine, the one that all the local machines talk to. Canada experimented with voting machines and dumped them, as did the Netherlands. This week it's Ireland. We should follow suit. It's not just that any technology, particularly a secret proprietary technology, is vulnerable to hackers. I mean, that's a big enough problem. But far more important is the concept of our commons. We have government of, by, and for the people to administer our commons, the things we all own in common, our roads and parks, our police and fire stations, our army, our libraries, our public schools. And, of course, government itself is the ultimate common. And the way that we tell government how to behave is through our vote. So the linchpin of our republic is the vote. It's the most critical of the commons, of the things that let us do everything else. And without any public debate or discussion, George W. Bush turned that most important part of the commons over to fewer than a half dozen very secretive and Republican Party-connected corporations. This is insane. We need to learn from Ireland's experience and sell our voting machines for scrap metal and go back to counting paper ballots by hand like virtually every other developed country in the world does. Privatizing our vote was a crime against democracy. It's time to undo that privatization crime of George W. Bush's and take our votes back from Diebold and other corporations. And if you want more information about this, check out Bev Harris's website, blackboxvoting.org. And I mean, it's just for years and years and years, there's a lot of people who've been toiling in this vineyard. And as I said, you know, these machines are vulnerable to hacking and fraud, but that's, frankly, in my opinion, that's not the biggest crime. The biggest crime is that our commons, the vote, has been sold off to Diebold.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where do we go with this? I think step one, we need to wake people up with the model of the commons. Talk about that.
Just a push of a button. Just a touch of a screen.
So how many major media outlets have you seen this story on about Ireland? They're literally selling their voting machines for scrap metal today. Put them up for sale. Did you see it on CNN? Fox? MSNBC? NBC? CBS? ABC? Hear it on NPR? Neither did I. Odd. Anderson Cooper, in an email to his friend Andrew Sullivan, which was published with his permission, says, yep, I'm gay, I'm proud, I'm happy, I'm doing just fine, thank you very much. In fact, basically what he was saying was that by being silent about his being gay, he was concerned that he was causing people to think that he was somehow ashamed of it or trying to hide it, which was not the case. Anderson Cooper being gay is probably the you know, in the media world, the best not kept non-secret. I mean, everybody in the media world for years has known that Anderson Cooper is gay. So God bless him for just speaking it out and saying it. It's another step forward and you know, good on you, Anderson Cooper. I just, you know, I want to say that. So, and Romney's top tax advisor says, at Obamacare, you know, the penalty that's going to hit about 1% of Americans that the Republicans are all huffing and puffing about, and they've got everybody, all the Republicans, hysterical that they're suddenly going to be faced with a tax. He says, it's not really a tax. You know, Romney did that same thing in Massachusetts. It's a fee or a penalty. It's a penalty. It's not a tax. How's Romney going to run on this thing? I mean, he's already, so far his differentiation is, well, you know, we did it at the state level, and the states should be free to say yes or no to something. You don't do it at the federal level and turn it into make a federal case out of it. I think most people are going to go, nah, I don't think so. But we will see. And $258 billion in Obamacare funds. Obamacare now, starting next year, is going to fund an expansion of Medicaid. Now, Medicare is for people over 65. Medicaid is for people who don't make a lot of money or who don't make any money. But also, probably the largest cohort of people who are using Medicaid are actually people who make very little money. But they're making money. They're working, and in many cases they're working full time, but they're not earning enough to be above 130% of the poverty level, which would be for a head of family with a family of four about $40,000, $43,000 a year. For an individual, it's around $14,000. So you just multiply that by four for a family of four. So if you're making under $40,000 and you're, you know, head of household for a family of four, under Obamacare, starting next year or the year after, when this thing becomes available, you could qualify for Medicare and get your health care for free. Free health insurance. Paid for, 100% paid for by the federal government. In part with this very small tax, I think it's 2.5% tax, on capital gains over $250,000. So only paid by basically Wall Street millionaires on capital gains, which the Republicans are trying to say, they're going to tax you if you sell your house. Well, only if you made $250,000 in the stock market that year. And your house is sold for a profit. But in any case, you've got all these Republican governors now. Nikki Haley just came out and said, yeah, in South Carolina, we're not going to take that money. They've got millions of poor and low-income people in South Carolina who would qualify for free Medicaid, free health insurance. And she's just saying to them, tough luck. Republicans don't care about poor people. Let them die. This is what Nikki Haley is saying. Rick Scott down in Florida just said the same thing. We're not going to take the money. Now, it's not the state taking the money. It's the state being the conduit to pass the money along to poor people in the state. And South Carolina and Florida are among the highest in the country in poor people. In fact, this Medicaid expansion, since it's designed for poor people, is by and large going to benefit red states. I mean, this is where you find the largest, by and large, you find the largest populations of poor people is in red states. So this is sometimes called a red state transfer. So how are people going to respond to this? The Republicans think this is going to be a winner, that they're going to stand up and say, no, we're not going to take the money. Now, going up to the election, I think politically it probably will be a winner, at least with their base, because there's no money that they're actually turning down. They're just proclaiming that next year they will turn the money down. But in fact, in all probability, if, you know, assuming that these various people are not running, most of them are not running for re-election, they will be governors next year, they won't turn the money down. They're not turning it down right now. Are they really going to say to 9.2 million uninsured, low-income Americans, sorry? Are they really going to say that to Walmart? You know, Walmart is one of the biggest users of Medicaid because so many Walmart employees, I mean, this is essentially part of their business model, is, you know, offer a really crappy health insurance plan that's really cheap. It's basically a disaster plan because your employees are making so little money they qualify for Medicaid. Is Walmart going to allow this to happen? Or are they going to sit these Republicans down and have a talk with them? But again, it'll all happen after November. The damage will be done.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
At least the electoral damage will be done. 27 minutes past the hour. Yeah, a lot's going to be decided there. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Hayden in Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Hayden, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I'd like your opinion on, is the repealing of the Affordable Care Act going to help Obama or Romney?
I don't know. I could build a case for either one. It helps Obama in as much as had it been knocked down, it would have been, he would have been perceived as having had his, you know, what is viewed as one of his major projects throughout his presidency being discredited and discarded by the Supreme Court. It would have fed that storyline that what he's doing is unconstitutional. By sustaining it, he's got that. On the other hand, the way that John Roberts knocked this down was like super sneaky. By saying that this was a tax, there are two kinds of legislation that passed through the Senate. There's legislation that has to do with laws, and there's legislation that has to do with money. Okay? Legislation that goes through the Senate that has to do with laws is subject to the filibuster. You can refuse to allow what's called cloture, the end of debate, and it takes 60 votes to break that filibuster. And so the Republicans have been able to block things, you know, going through the Democratic Congress, through the Democratic Senate. And vice versa, if there were, say, 51 Republican senators after the election, and they're looking at some of these state races, you know, very, very aggressively. I mean, they're going after Sherrod Brown like there's no tomorrow, for example, in Ohio. And so if they had 51 senators, Republican senators, that's not enough to overcome a filibuster. But the filibuster only applies to laws about laws. Laws or legislation that has to do with taxing is subject to what's called reconciliation, which means that it can't be filibustered in short form. And so by identifying Obamacare's fee this penalty that between 1% and 3% of Americans may end up paying, and which will be, you know, a few hundred dollars a year, by identifying that as a tax, what the Robert Court has done is has thrown Obamacare into the realm of tax, where we talked about this on Friday on this program. We had a caller call in and talk about it. I talked about it on my TV show Friday night, and then on Sunday, Mitch McConnell on Fox News just came right out and said it, that if the Republicans can get 51 votes in the Senate after the elections, they'll bring Obamacare up by under reconciliation rules because it has to do with taxes, and it can't be filibustered. The Democrats won't be able to stop them, and, you know, they will take it out. And if they do, take out Obamacare, and Hayden, thanks for the call. And here's my prophecy, my prediction of how they would do it. They would take down Obamacare by reconciliation. Then they would take all the popular pieces of Obamacare, which people don't understand because the Democrats have done such a poor job of messaging this, or the media has done such a poor job of informing the American public what's in Obamacare. And they have done that because they're afraid of, you know, because this whole work the refs thing that goes back to Lee Atwater, they're just terrified of saying anything nice about Obamacare and getting slammed by Republicans. So in any case, most Americans don't know with Obamacare, you can't be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. So the Republicans will pass that as a law and they'll take all the credit for it. Or kids can stay on their parents' policies until they're 26. The Republicans will pass that as a law and they'll take credit for it. Or children can't be denied. I mean, right now it's children. In 2 years, it'll be everybody can't be denied because of pre-existing conditions. Rescission. The insurance companies used to say, oh, you're getting expensive. We're going to drop you from the policy. They can't do that anymore. As of last year, they can't do that anymore. So the Republicans, after they knock down Obamacare, they'll just pass a law saying you can't have rescission. And my guess is that they'll end up basically putting back together Obamacare 100%, but they will brand it in a different kind of brand because it is a Republican idea. I mean, it was started by the Heritage Foundation as a response to Hillary Care. Remember that? Hillary Care was more of a giant public option program, the Bill and Hillary Clinton put together. And the health insurance industry went nuts. They hired the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation came up with this program that then Mitt Romney sold. The president of the Heritage Foundation was standing right there when Mitt Romney signed it into law in Massachusetts. And then Hillary campaigned on that. Obama said, nah, you know, we really need a public option. And you know, he was campaigning on Hillary Care. But then, you know, once he became president, it was the only way that he could get it past people like Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu. So anyhow, net-net, I think that the Republicans will adopt this. They'll knock it down, they'll adopt it, they'll claim credit for it. They will, you know, if they take the House, Senate, and the White House, they will spend money like there's no tomorrow, just like they did during the Reagan and Bush, and both Bush presidencies, and make it look like it's good times. They'll create another bubble that'll probably pop just as a Democrat is about to become president. I mean, this is kind of a horrible dystopian perspective. But anyhow, that's my take on all of that. I, you know, pardon the long thing. John in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, or Point? Is it Point?
Port. Yes, I saw on one of the network news programs an interview with the CEO of the AIG Corporation.
All right.
And he said that he believed the retirement age should be raised to 80.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What I'm wondering
we
is...
We reported on that here, too, about a week and a half ago, yeah.
Well, does he contribute or his company contribute to the Romney campaign and or a Romney super PAC?
I think you could count on it, but, you know, I don't have any specific evidence of that. But there is this particularly pernicious strain within the conservative movement. And what they're really not saying that they think that the retirement age should be raised to 80. Or, you know, the more moderate ones, they're saying raise the retirement age to 70. And it's just, you know, it's a camel's nose under the edge of the tent. What they're really trying to do is destroy Social Security. At the end of the day, they'll say, okay, well, we take it up to 70. Let's take it up to 75. And you know, let's bring in some private stuff. You know, bring in the for-profit insurance companies to fill in the gaps. And you know, while people still have the ability to work or they still have some income or they still have a little bit of equity left in their home or they can still borrow on their credit cards so that they can deplete all of their savings, giving them to the insurance companies. And, you know, eventually, you know, this is all part of the plan. And thanks for the call, John, and for pointing this out. This is all part of the plan to destroy Social Security. And what's so tragic about that is, and what most Americans don't get, is that if you're 20 years old and listening to this program right now or 30 years old or 40 years old, And you're thinking, Social Security is so far away, I don't have to worry about that. Social Security is your backstop right this minute. It's got nothing to do with retirement. A third of all the money that Social Security pays out does not go to retired people. It goes to people like my friend Michael Hutchison, who lives in Santa Fe, who in his 40s, I believe he was, in his early 40s, in fact, he was out in the winter going for a run, was running across this bridge that was covered with ice and had a low railing on the side, slipped and just tumbled right over the edge of the bridge into the river and landed on his head and broke his neck. And Michael has been paralyzed from the neck down. He's a quadriplegic, has been paralyzed from the neck down ever since. I mean, it's been like, you know, 15, 20 years. And Social Security disability pays for all of Michael's expenses. They pay for his living, for his health insurance, you know, for everything. That's an insurance policy, literally a lifetime insurance policy that's worth at least $1 million to $2 million over the course of a lifetime. That if you're 20 years old, you have right now. A third of Social Security is the widow, disabled, and orphans, survivors benefits stuff. Kids whose parents both get killed in a car wreck. Social Security pays for them. And on it goes. So, you know, these guys, they want to take this apart because they're looking at that Social Security trust fund, $2.5 trillion, and saying, can you imagine how much money Wall Street can siphon out of this thing? Eli in Fargo, North Dakota. Hey, Eli, what's up? Or is it Ellie?
Hi, Tom.
Oh, it's Ellie. I'm sorry.
My name is Ellie.
Two L's.
Hey. You were talking about the voting machines in Ireland, and we have a little bit better, I think, version of it in Minnesota, where when you vote, you fill in a mark sense form. And then our machines are basically just scanners and tabulators. Right. It scans it, tabulates the vote, gives you a tape at the end of the night, which I'm an election worker in my district, and we have to take like a cash register tape, basically,
right,
and physically count and make those two numbers match.
So you physically count the ballots, but you're not counting the votes on the ballots. We had those machines in Vermont when I lived there, and we used them, and they used them in Oregon when I lived there, you know, for the vote by mail. And, you know, they're like the machines that you use to tabulate a test, you know, in school, you know, where you fill in the little bubbles.
We do have to count the votes. We have to, because it actually tabulates out how many for each one. And we have to make
so you do an audit
balance.
because the way to keep these machines honest is to pull randomly like 1 or 2% of the votes of the, you know, and actually audit them. And I know in Vermont and Oregon, they were not doing that. And there was a big kerfuffle about it because it's an enormous amount of work.
Yeah, it is. And one of the other things, too, is our machines are not networked. So they're, as far as being able to hack.
Right.
They're not on any kind of a local area network or anything like that.
You know, I would not object to this, Ellie, I would not object to this if the machines were owned by the local government.
I think that's a great idea.
So that the local government contractors using open source software that was available to anybody could program them and say, here's the programming. It's no longer a black box. My concern is that those machines are owned by private corporations. And you as an election worker, and in fact the elected officials in your state, do not have access to the source code. You have no way of knowing what that machine is doing when it tells you it's counting the vote. And that's wrong. That's the privatization of the vote that I'm so strongly objecting to. Ellie, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and predictably, Congressman Alan West, Obama wants to enslave America. America, yeah. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And movement politics. You know, let me just add one thing. Somebody called a little while ago and was asking, you know, about an Occupy person that they saw on TV or radio or something who was saying, you know, I'm not going to get involved in politics. I'm not going to vote, you know, curse pox on all their houses. And I said, well, you know, there are some people who are part of fringe political groups that just think that the entire American system is horrible and destructive and needs to be torn down. And I think that they're very much a minority, but they would say that kind of thing. And then there are some folks who are just disillusioned. But then there's a third thing. And that third thing is movement politics. And movement politics, frankly, in my opinion, should be separate from, well, not necessarily should be, but very often works most effectively when it's separate from partisan politics. In other words, a movement to have national health care. a movement to have peace in the world, a movement for civil rights. The civil rights movement was fiercely nonpartisan, although it was ultimately embraced by Democrats and rejected by Republicans. Martin Luther King never, to the best of my knowledge, declared his political affiliation. Republicans have tried to claim that he was a Republican back, you know, early on before the Democrats embraced civil rights in the 60s, back in the 40s or 50s. Maybe, but probably not. But in any case, there is something to be said for political movements not being partisan, but saying to their individual members, whatever you do on election day is up to you. But the important thing is getting the movement out there. And that's something that we really, really need. Mike in Berlin, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I am really worried about November. I visited small town America over the weekend. Okay? Mm-hmm. I went to Iowa. And normal, you know, this is a normal quasi-progressive area, actually. And everywhere I go, bars, restaurants, blaring is Fox News.
Yeah.
And all weekend, nothing, nonstop, 24/7, is anti-Obamacare. Obamacare bad, taxation, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And I'm really afraid that the message is going to be like this until November. People are not going to see reality. They're going to see what Fox and the Romney camp want to portray, and it's a complete lie.
Yeah.
And it's just it really scares me.
No, it's really remarkable. I was over at the RT studios this morning before I came over here to do the radio show, and they've got, you know, four monitors up for the cable networks in RT. And Fox was on, of course, and the Chiron, they were interviewing a doctor who was a psychologist who was talking about the psychological impact of Obamacare and how it's causing Americans to become a nation of sheep who will be more easily corrupted by a dictator because they've all decided, you know, because Obamacare teaches us to take things from the government. And it's like, what? You know, Fox News should be registered as a political organization, and Fox News programming that is partisan like that should be considered political advertising. But, you know, saying that is a two-edged sword, because that would mean that what I'm doing is political advertising, too. So, you know, as much as I can fume and bluster, I think at the end of the day we both have to acknowledge free speech goes a long way in this country. It would be, and you know, you've got to balance Fox, you've got MSNBC and Free Speech TV and others, but and RT. But there is a machine, there is a right wing machine out there that is huge and is well funded and serves the interests of the billionaires in this country. And that's the thing that concerns me the most.
I just really wish that there could be an honest, you know, thoughtful discussion of this issue. And I can understand people have different opinions on things, but this isn't discussion.
No, these Republicans are total, they're complete bullies. They are take no prisoners. They're not up for honest or thoughtful conversations. They're saying this is the biggest tax increase in history. No, nonsense. It's not even a tax increase. It's actually cutting taxes. It's cutting the federal budget. It's increasing efficiency. It's reducing health care costs. But, you know, that doesn't stop them from lying. You're right, Mike. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Russ in Sheridan, Wyoming. Hey, Russ, what's up?
Tom, I'm going to ask you, who paid for Dick Cheney's heart transplant?
You and me.
Did the federal government pay for that, or did Halliburton, who paid for that?
Well, actually, you know, it's not inconceivable that he has some private health insurance left over from Halliburton. I don't know. I'm assuming that it was you and me, that it was done through the medical care that he got as being a former vice president. I believe that the surgery was done at the Naval Hospital, Walter Reed, although I may be wrong. I don't know. I would guess that it was us, though. I would guess very much that it was us. Russ, thanks for the call. Dave in Humboldt County, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I'm a long-time admirer. I used to go back to you and your mutual friend, Alice.
Oh, yeah.
I'm also Bertrand Russell on your chat room, and I think what you are doing today is so marvelous. I fear I became too much of a regular caller, so now I only call you once every year or two, but what you're doing today is the hope for saving this country. Our media has failed us completely. We're not hearing anywhere that election fraud has been rampant in our country. We only listen to what they put in place there, their Fox News, to lie to us, and we need to do something. I say we need to be today out in the streets with signs, become support, occupy here, you know, join now, end election fraud. It's so important to us, and it's we're not hearing it anywhere. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing, Tom.
You're welcome, Dave. Thank you for the call and for the validation. I think it's really important that we be pointing out that our elections are in the hands of private, for-profit corporations who will not let us, they will not let we the people look at their software or look inside their hardware in any meaningful way. And that is, you know, when George Bush signed that law in 2002, the Help America Vote Act, the privatizing our vote, that was the ultimate assault on the beating heart of democracy, to paraphrase Thomas Paine. We'll be back with Kerry Lucas.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Kerry Lucas, we've been having some weirdnesses electronically here. Can you hear me, Kerry? I cannot hear you. You can see her levels, but you can't hear her. Oh, my. Kerry, can you just... Actually, we should call you. We are going to call you on the telephone so that we can talk on the phone. And... yeah, that's you can still make an international phone call. It's no problem. Remember Jonathan Crohn? By the way, I wanted to tell you all about this. I do CPAC every year, and have for 5 or 6 years, the Conservative Political Action Committee or conference here in Washington D.C. The big, you know, hoop de doop get together where all the conservatives are. And a couple of years ago at CPAC, this little kid, and I say little kid, he was 13 years old. Jonathan Crohn, this must have been 4 years ago, not only came on my program and debated me, and he had a book out, and his mom was walking him around like a stage mom, you know, and he was had all these conservative talking points down and had them all figured out and all this stuff. Not only debated me on the air, but literally when I would walk off to go to the men's room or something, or just, you know, leave the conference, if he saw me, he would just start walking with me and continue trying to debate me. Jonathan, it turns out, is now 17 and a liberal. Just thought you might want to know. Okay, Kerry Lucas, we have you?
Yes, you sure do.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom. I'm sorry about that.
No, it's not your fault. It's on our end. We had a problem with our dump button last week, you know, the time delay thing. And
okay.
I think in the process of fixing that, we broke something else. So I'm sorry.
I don't know how all this works.
Yeah, so. Our Skype audio is not working. I don't have it figured out either, but we will have it figured out by the end of the day after we get off the air. So anyhow, you are the managing director of the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org. And welcome back to our program. I find this, Kerry, just astounding. The tax part of Obama-Romney-Care is, or I should call it the Heritage Foundation's Obama-Romney-Care. The tax part of it is paid by, in Massachusetts, less than 1% of the people in the state. And the most pessimistic estimates for the United States nationwide are 3 to 5%. And most estimates, the CBO estimates, for example, are 1 to 3%. And the maximum would be $695, or 2.5% of your income, and that's assuming that you make more than $44,000 a year. If you make less than that for a family of four, there's no tax at all. So we're talking about something that's only going to hit a very small number of people, to the tune of like $700 a year at the most, and that's if David Koch decides not to have health insurance. And yet you've got Mike Crapo saying, you know, now we're back in that argument. Bobby Jindal, they've called this a tax. Scott Walker and others, you know, this is the biggest tax in history. You know, Scott Walker says this is a massive tax increase. Come on. I mean, the tax increase that the Republicans wanted to hit us with by not extending the payroll tax cut would have been $1,500 per person per year, and it wouldn't have hit 1% of Americans. It would have hit about 40% of Americans.
Well, Tom, you know, you're talking about, we're just talking right now about the individual mandate tax, how much. Now, the Supreme Court's decided that this isn't just a mandate, that it's a tax, so it's this, you know, less than $700 tax.
Right.
And that is, you're right, that's a
John Roberts
minor
also said it can be both a penalty and a tax at the same time. But yeah.
Sure. So, I mean, this is compared to, you know, and yes, okay, $700 isn't, that's not the biggest deal in the world. The problem is that's just one of, scores of taxes that are included in the entire Obamacare package, which dwarfs this. And you're right. You know, I think it's funny that, first of all, you know, I think that liberals have to love that they're now in the position of talking about, is this the biggest tax increase in history or not? And how, just how regressive is it? But I actually agree with you, Tom. I think you're right that, you know, $700 isn't the end of the world for people in the middle income who are going to say, wow, you know, health insurance costs are going through the roof because of all the mandates that are included in Obamacare. So I can't afford this anymore. Sure, I'll pay the $700. I'll get insurance once I get real sick. So you're right. I think that people, you know, are going to see this as not that big a deal. They're going to pay it, and our insurance, there's going to be a huge adverse
problem. As happens in Massachusetts right now.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. You know, if you're expecting me to come in here and defend the Massachusetts health care plan because of trying to defend candidate Romney, then you're very mistaken. And I think that, you know, the Romney has he may not have officially backed away from Massachusetts, but he's promising to that he would move to reverse Obamacare. And that's, frankly, at this point, good enough for me. And yes, I think that the Americans should take a look at Massachusetts and see that this is this doesn't work.
So what do you not like about saying to health insurance companies, as every other country in the world does, you may not cut somebody off just because they got sick? Rescission.
Well, Tom, that's such a ridiculous way to put this, because that's absolutely not what people are talking about. What you're talking
they
about
are when they get sick.
No. Once if you have a contract with an insurance company, in the same way that if I go crash my car, it would be, you know, my insurance provider couldn't walk away from me and say, oh, sorry, your insurance is cut off now. And that's why we have contracts, and judges and courts are supposed to enforce those contracts.
Carrie, have you ever read your insurance policy?
No, of course not. It's a million pages, and nobody in their right mind with it.
But you want to rely on whatever's in policy that nobody in their right mind would read?
Well, no, Tom.
Because that's the contract.
I wish we didn't have such stupid regulations from the government that made these policies unreasonable.
The government didn't establish all that language that says that if you get really expensive, the insurance company can cut you off. The insurance company, the lawyers for the insurance company, did that, Carrie.
Okay, well, Tom, but you know what? This is the problem. Is, you know, absolutely. You know what? Our insurance system is not perfect. But what you have and I think that we should be shopping around. I should have a lot more control. I should have a lot more. I should do my homework on what my insurance.
Okay, then let me ask you another question. What part of having a free market exchange where all the health insurance companies in the country are basically brought into every single state and have to compete against each other?
What part of having a free market exchange
do you oppose? I don't understand why Scott Walker and Bobby Jindal are against these free market exchanges.
It's always funny, I think, when liberals start talking as if pretending that this is some, you know, free market thing, which you...
It's competition.
Wait. But, Tom, basically, okay, if you have a marketplace and everybody has to sell apples, and it's this wonderful, you know, market full where all these different sellers of apples, but
right,
they can only sell red apples, they can only sell them for 5 cents per apple. Is that a beautiful free market exchange? No.
But see, the health insurance exchanges, Carrie, do not specify price. I mean, this is one of the hits on Obamacare is that they don't specify price. They rely on competition. If everybody is selling apples in the marketplace, to use your example, then and you and I are walking through the marketplace, I'm guessing we're going to start saying, you know, that looks like a better apple than that one. Or
okay,
I've heard that this brand tastes better.
Apples is a really bad example because that would be an affordable thing, but instead it's saying that we've all got our grocery bags. Instead of me just saying, you know, I'm trying to save money, so I'm only going to buy, you know, these 10 items that my family actually eats and that you're going to say no. Like, everybody
but,
has to have
but
the
Carrie, most right now, in more than half the states in the United States, you can only buy insurance from two companies. In some states, you can only buy from one. Why do conservatives resist the idea of every state setting up an exchange where all the companies can compete?
No, Tom, we don't resist that. That's why conservatives have been calling for things like saying we should be able to buy our
But why is Scott Walker saying he's not going to put the exchange into place? Why is Rick Scott saying he's not going to do it? Why did Nikki Haley come out today and say she's not going to do it?
These exchanges aren't competition. It is a government.
How is a dozen companies in a marketplace competing for your business, not competition?
Wait, Tom, let me interrupt you for a second. Why is it that liberals won't let me buy an insurance policy from any other state? You are right now. Let's have, okay.
The exchange would do that. The exchange would do that. You could buy from any company based anywhere.
Okay, but then get rid of these regulations. Get rid of let's not have it so I can only buy one bag of groceries with what you say are in it. That's not competition. It's not a free
Carrie, market. I will leave you with the last word. Carrie Lucas, IWF.org. Thank you, Carrie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. How are we going to slice this baby? What kind of Solomonic wisdom are the Republicans going to bring to this? Somehow I doubt much. We'll see. Well, one of the things that war does produce is a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Deepak Chopra is with us, a physician, author of 65 books, founder of the Chopra Foundation, Deepak, DEEPAK CHOPRA.com. DeepakChopra.com is his website. And by the way, our friends at WCPT in Chicago offer you a chance to win tickets to attend the Deepak Chopra's retreat, Seduction of Spirit, Pathways to Happiness, July 9th through the 15th of this year at the Englewood Resort and Spa in Chicago. You can click on the banner at chicagosprogressivetalk.com for that. Dr. Chopra, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us about your work with post-traumatic stress disorder. What is this, and how do we deal with this crisis? I saw today, I think it was 13 American vets or GIs are committing suicide every day now in the United States. It's terrible.
Yes, it's especially common, as you just mentioned, in American veterans or anybody who's suffered the trauma of war and conflict that is not part of the norm of our daily living. And then that episode is recorded somewhere in your consciousness like a tape loop, and it keeps replaying itself. And when it replays itself, then, you know, your brain starts to go into an alert mode, and it starts to secrete adrenaline and cortisol, which throws you into what is called the fight or flight mode, as if you were actually in the bunker facing those bullets in the midst of all that mayhem and people dying around you and in terror of your own immediate death. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful and it's so automatic that you feel totally at loss to control it. It overwhelms your biology, and it can result in physical symptoms of heart disease, cardiovascular disease, but inflammation in the body. And some people are so overwhelmed by it that they actually commit suicide because they would rather not be in that state anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's a memory that's almost imprinted in your cells.
Yeah, I've heard a description that our short-term memory scratch pad, the hippocampus, typically dumps the day's memories during the night as we sleep, and the brain processes it and sorts it and stores it. And that with PTSD, that doesn't happen. That it's such a huge and horrible memory that the short-term scratch pad transition into long-term memory can't happen. And so every day it's there as today's memory. Does that make sense?
Correct. No, that's totally correct. So the hippocampus basically fails to do its job, and that is because it's overwhelmed by the overload the data, overload with huge emotional content to it.
Right.
Normally in sleep, we download that or release that emotional content. That's what we call dreams.
Yep.
And, you know, the dreams are suppressed, or then some people have so much suppression that they actually begin to hallucinate and dream while awake, which is even worse.
Mm-hmm. So how do you, I know Francine Shapiro came up with this, you know, EMDR thing, and there's been everything from electroconvulsive shock therapy to the use of, you know, a variety of pharmaceuticals to, you know, good old-fashioned Jungian and Freudian psychotherapy. But I don't think that any of them have been identified as magic bullets. EMDR has a lot of research associated with it. What are you recommending?
Well, again, there's no one thing that would be effective in everybody. So EMDR will be effective in some people, not effective in others. I think it's a combination of things. You have to try everything. These days, one of the things that is becoming increasingly popular, and we've had success even with veterans, I've had some success, it's something called cognitive therapy, where you actually take the person actively and relive that memory, then bring them to the present moment and ask them whether they are that memory. And there's a process. Is this true for me now? Am I 100% sure if this is true for me now? What is this experience of holding on to this memory doing to me? Who would I be without that? And what is the way out of it? There's more reflection than actually direction. And the more people reflect, the more they realize that they can, in fact, still have the memory but not be used by the memory.
Well, this is... I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I have an expression. I use memories, but I don't allow memories to use me.
Right.
And if you can get somebody to that place, because you can't erase the memory. The memory, once it's imprinted, it's there. What you can do is you can overshadow it with new memories,
right,
which are more joyful, exhilarating, energizing. And you can also go to take people into a deep state of meditation where they actually transcend that memory. And the more they have that experience of inner silence, of transcending that memory, the more independent they seem to feel of it. And then, of course, there are all other modalities, you know, the nurturing relationships, people around you who really give you almost unconditional love and are there with you and make you feel safe, exercise, physical exercise, massage, music therapy. There's lots of things you can do, and, you know, it's not one thing, though.
That's remarkable. And it sounds like these are the kind of things that, in particular, this, you know, not I use my memories, I'm not used by my memories, is a way to let go of any kind of childhood trauma through your life, bad boss trauma, pretty much, you know, bad stories that you use to define yourself.
Cognitive therapy, you know, it is the basis of all cognitive therapy. There are a variety of ways of doing this process, but it's been found to be very useful, yes.
Marvelous. Dr. Deepak Chopra and our friends at WCPT in Chicago, you can check out this Seduction of Spirit, Pathways to Happiness, July 9th through the 15th. Click on the banner at chicagosprogressivetalk.com. Dr. Chopra, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Have you had an experience of just completely transcending yourself? That would be an interesting topic to get into. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And FYI, for the record, I didn't want to do it while Dr. Chopra was on the line, but I have some familiarity with EMDR and NLP and all this stuff, and actually was trained by by Richard Bandler as an NLP practitioner. Actually, it was Life Roland through whom I got my NLP practitioner certification, and then by Richard Bandler himself in London as an NLP trainer. And I wrote a book about dealing with trauma and PTSD. It's titled Walking Your Blues Away, and it's about bilateral therapies in general, from hypnosis to simply walking and carrying pictures and finding ways to transcend these things. There's some pretty potent stuff out there, and some very powerful stuff. Ada. Is it Ada or Ada in Denver?
It's Ada.
Ada, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. About 9 years ago, I was involved in a head-on collision in southern Colorado with a big old truck in the middle of a blizzard.
Whoa.
And I died once on the scene, and then I was revived and taken to a nearby city for treatment. Mm-hmm. And when I came to the first time after being in coma for 11 days, I thought I had been kidnapped and taken to southern Arizona for testing on letting robots manage my death. And I took my ventilator out a couple times and died again. And
yikes.
So I've gone through a whole bunch of different things, and I had some what they called PTSD treatment down there, but I moved to Denver about 4 years ago and started through my healthcare provider trying to work a little harder on it because I was having that cortisol release and I did mm-hmm. not have a flight or fight response. I just had a fight response.
Hmm.
Someone would cut me off in traffic, I'd want to...
You'd get raged.
Absolutely. Enraged. Yeah. And I was carrying a baseball bat in my car and so I turned myself in for some work. Well, they had a specialist who had been studying the EMDR method where you hold the two little probes in your hand and it gives you a small electric shock like a little 12-volt battery.
Mm-hmm.
You adjust the amount of the shock. Then we did the regression.
Yeah, if I can interrupt you, this is one of the forms of so for our listeners, this is a what's called a bilateral form of therapy. It involves getting the brain to go left brain, right brain, and you do it by stimulating the body left side, right side. So I'm assuming that the little electric sensation that you felt, it wasn't a shock, actually, it was just a tingle.
Yeah,
went left hand, right hand, right?
Exactly.
While you were thinking about the experience. And that allows the whole brain to process the memory, which allows the hippocampus to dump it into the brain.
Right.
Back to you.
And after the first treatment, I went home and I didn't feel like I was walking on the ground. And he advised me to be very careful, to rest and take care, and he checked in. I had two more treatments. During the second treatment, I actually felt it. Either I left my body or it left my body. I can't mm-hmm. completely describe what happened. But since then, I have added a physical modality called I Chi, which is like doing Tai Chi, but it's in the water. Mm-hmm. Because of the severity of my injuries, I was in a wheelchair for a long time. I can now walk with a cane. And most of the time now, I don't even need the cane. But by combining the two and getting the physical modality with meditation like I do in the water therapy, I've really had some more profound changes. And I just went in last week, and just walking in the room to meet with that therapist set the whole situation back up for me again, and we got through a little kind of, shall we say, a drip, drip, drip that was coming through just a little
mm-hmm.
in a matter of like 10 minutes. And it is the most important thing that's happened, and it's really helped me change my life.
Yeah, it really truly does. This is a technique, this bilateral technique of stimulating one side of the body and then the other, that was actually first developed by Franz Anton Mesmer back in the mm-hmm. 1700s. And Ben Franklin went to a demonstration of it in Paris and was
wow.
blown away by it. And I write about this in my book, Walking Your Blues Away. I give the whole history of it. Mesmer called it mesmerism, and he would have people, he thought it was energy from the moon, right? And so he would hold his left hand up in the air, and with his right hand, he would wave it in front of their face, side to side. So their eyes would go left, right, while they were remembering the awful experience. And he found that this would completely discharge it and cure them of what was back then referred to as hysteria. Sigmund Freud, that was through the late 1700s into the early 1800s. Then in 1824, as I recall, it's been about a decade since I wrote the book, so I'm working on memory here that's a decade old, but I think it was 1824, might have been the early 1830s, a Scottish physician by the name of Dr. James Braid concluded, he was a student of Mesmer's, not a direct student, he didn't know him, but he knew of his work. Mesmer at that point was dead or dying. But it had become this rage, mesmerism, and all these people were like channeling the moon's energy, right? And Braid said, this has nothing to do with being a good channel, because some people said they were better channels than others because they could move the energy through their bodies. He said, that's nonsense. It's got nothing to do with the moon, and it's got nothing to do with energy. It has to do with the eyes moving back and forth, and I'll prove it. And so he got a bunch of people who had experienced trauma, and he held a pocket watch in front of them and moved it back and forth in front of their eyes and put them into the same hypnotic trance that Mesmer was able to do and healed them in the same way of these illnesses, these psychological illnesses. And so he named this neurohypnosis, and then in the 1840s he renamed it hypnosis. And it became the modality du jour for most of the 19th century. Sigmund Freud started it in 1880. He was practicing it aggressively with, I forget Brown's, B-R-A-U-N's first name, but it was his partner. And the two of them, he was, and Freud in his books, Studies on Hysteria, which was published in the late 1880s, maybe early 1890s, wrote about this, how he used hypnosis for all his diagnosis. It was his primary therapeutic model. They used it on Anna O, who was the main topic of the book, Studies in Hysteria. And then all of a sudden in 1898, Sigmund Freud stopped using hypnosis. In fact, everybody stopped using it. And he started using, first he tried cocaine, and he did that for 5 or 6 years. He became badly addicted to it. Many of his patients did. His best friend died from a cocaine-induced suicidal psychosis. And then Freud stopped. And then he came up with the Oedipus and Electra complex. You know, it's all about mom. It's all about dad. And that didn't go anywhere. And then now we're in the 1900s. By around, that was 1906 or 7. And then by 1912, he was talking about talk therapy and psychotherapy. And he really never got his mojo back. He never got back to 1898. And I spent a year, a good solid year, researching the psychological literature, trying to figure out why Freud abandoned hypnosis. And in fact, why all of these guys abandoned hypnosis. And what I discovered, and I've never seen this written anyplace else, and I put it in Walking Your Blues Away, what I discovered was that there were the two best-selling books of the entire 19th century were Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was published in the 1850s, and I think 1855, and a book called Trilby by de Maurier. And Trilby was published in 1897, and it was the best-selling book in the world. It was published in dozens of different languages, and it was the story of this sweet, innocent little 16-year-old girl who is a model for artists, and these three nasty artists, or this one in particular, who were artists in Paris who had her model for them, and one of them took her off, hypnotized her, and exploited her sexually and had her sing in front of as an opera star and under hypnosis, and he took all the money, and she would wake, and then he would take her back and he would have sex with her, and then he would take her out of the trance, and she'd wake up just again thinking she was just this poor model, you know, and in the end of the book she finds out what's happened and she breaks the trance and they both die, and it's this tragic thing. His name was Svengali. And that's where it came from. And he was described in the book as being Jewish. And they used and de Maurier used all these Jewish, anti-Semitic Jewish stereotypes to describe Svengali. And so here's Sigmund Freud, who's a Jewish psychiatrist, who had been for two decades having women, and it was 99% of the clients in that day were women. They, you know, of PTSD, sure. Men just didn't go for therapy. And having women, you know, lay down on the couch, and then he would put his hand in front of them and wave it from side to side and tell them that he was putting them into a trance, which is exact. It's described in detail in the book Trilby. I went out and got a copy and read the book, and it just blew my mind. So here's all these educated women who are seeing this nasty Jewish guy, Svengali, waving his hand back and forth in front of this woman. So what obviously what happened was Freud and any other therapist, particularly if they were Jewish, but even if they weren't, who tried, you know, hypnotizing people, was just, you know, blown out of the water. Hypnosis became radioactive.
Mm-hmm.
And hypnosis is really just a bilateral therapy. And what EMDR is, what Francine Shapiro developed, is, you know, moving your eyes back and forth, eye motion desensitization and reintegration, EMDR. And I took it a step further. Back when I used to have a practice consulting with psychologists and psychiatrists, I was giving them advice on how to integrate NLP into the practice. I started asking them if they would have their clients just walk and hold their memories, because that's bilateral too. And we found that, you know, typically in about 2 weeks of doing that for a half hour a day, incredible breakthroughs would happen. So I wrote a book about it. But anyhow, Ada, thank you so much for the call and giving me a chance to share that story with you. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So you never know what kind of rant I'm going to go off on. That was our psychotherapy moment for the week. We'll be back.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grave.
See, there you go. You laugh at sad news, right? I saw the photograph. Actually, there's an NLP technique that has to do with a modality that has to do with making a picture of a bad memory, turning it black and white, pushing it off into the distance, painting it on glass, and shattering it with an imaginary rock that you throw, and the bad memories go away. It's a really, really, really powerful psychotherapeutic technique. The Beatles are so ahead of all of this stuff. You know, they're just so ahead of it all. Anyhow, Talk Radio News. This Talk Radio News Service's report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, in the world of healthcare, we've had a fascinating split in the Republican ranks, where over the weekend, the entire Republican establishment was all over the Sunday shows and anywhere else they could go, saying that the Supreme Court decision last week meant that the individual mandate is, in fact, a tax, because Chief Justice Roberts, in his opinion, has said it was within the taxing authority. Today, Eric Fernstrom, senior campaign advisor for Mitt Romney, says that he disagrees with that, and says that the governor believes, Mitt Romney, that what we put in place in Massachusetts was a penalty, and he disagrees with the court's ruling that it is not a tax. In other words, he believes that it is a penalty.
So here's an argument with some integrity. I'm guessing that the ipso sum or whatever, the therefore of that argument would be, and therefore, the court wrongly decided on the Commerce Clause argument, which is what they should have argued. They should have decided on, which is what the other five wackadoodle conservatives wanted to base the decision on.
Yes, he said also that he agreed with the dissent, which was written by Justice Scalia,
right.
And the dissent clearly stated that the mandate was not a tax.
Right, and therefore it should have been knocked down under the Commerce Clause. And for the record, I'm not stipulating that by saying yes, you agree with me that they're wackadoodles. I realize you have your integrity as a reporter to protect. So what else is going on?
So the other thing that we should mention with regard to healthcare law is something that the House of Representatives intends to do as soon as it comes back next week, which is to introduce legislation to prohibit the IRS from implementing the healthcare law, from receiving any money from the Department of Health and Human Services, so that would slow implementation down. This is part of a general slow walk because Republicans still believe that with a change in the White House in November, this law can be overturned, and so if they can slow walk it now, that is the route to go. So that is a vote that will be coming up.
Right, and they're trying to do a change in the Senate, because by determining that this was a tax and not using the Commerce Clause argument, what John Roberts did was he said, if you can get 51 votes in the Senate, you can knock this thing down, because tax laws can't be filibustered. They can be done under reconciliation. And so if the Republicans can get a majority in the Senate, the Democrats won't be able to filibuster them. They won't be able to stop them.
And Senator Mitch McConnell is hoping to do that before the election.
Before the election?
He seems to have flipped. initially he was saying that he wasn't going to, but he seems to have flipped and be saying that he's going to try and do that.
What, has he got a couple of Democratic senators on his side?
I don't know, because I would be very, very surprised.
I wonder if they're, I mean, all he needs is a couple. I wonder if the health insurance industry is offering, you know, $3 million a year to ex-Democratic senators who want to come work for them as lobbyists and a couple of retiring Democrat. Nah.
Health insurance industry likes the individual mandate.
Yeah, you're right. It wouldn't be them. Who would it be? It would be the Koch brothers or something. I mean, it would be somebody who's just looking for political advantage out of this, not actual... Who is arguing against this on policy grounds, Victoria? I mean, I understand the if we can take down Obamacare, we wound the president. And that's why I predicted that the Republicans, if they could take it down, they would replace it with something that was identical and they'd just rebrand it. But on policy grounds, is anybody making an argument or is this just political?
It's philosophy. It's not even policy, I don't think. I think it's sheer philosophy. It is that we
ideology.
Ideology. We do not believe in this as though it's a sort of religion. We don't believe in this. We will not have European-style healthcare here, which is one of the things that Mitch McConnell said in that classic answer that he gave yesterday when he was asked for the third time by Chris Wallace, what are you going to do about the 30 million unemployed, uninsured? And he said, that is not the issue.
Right. So, okay, got it.
So I think it's ideology.
Yeah, which I would translate into politics, frankly. But
yeah,
because I don't hear if they're going to replace it with something that's going to do the same thing, then it can't be ideology because they're still embracing the idea of insuring everybody.
But that's politics too.
Yeah, that's my point.
So it's politics. Yeah, your point. Absolutely. Iran has begun its second day of fairly biting sanctions from the European Union on its oil. And there are signs that these are hurting its economy and really alarming those in power. And one of the questions now arising is, are they going to respond to this? The European put a sanction basically on all oil coming out of Iran.
Yeah. You know what frightens me about this, Victoria? Do you know what the United States did that provoked Japan to attack us at Pearl Harbor?
You've told me this before.
We barricaded or blocked, or whatever the word is, the Straits of Malacca, which is the overseas path past Singapore and Malaysia where the oil from the Middle East went to Japan. We blocked the flow of oil into Japan, and they responded by bombing us at Pearl Harbor. And... when a rat is cornered, it gets nasty. And I'm not saying that a rat is a rat. I'm just saying, that's the mammalian response. You know, when humans get cornered, they get nasty. So this concerns me. On the other hand, it might cause the fall of the Ahmadinejad government, which may or may not be a good thing. And we'll see how it plays out. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can get more information at germany.info.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our third hour. And you know I shared with you earlier, we've been talking about Obamacare on and off throughout the day here. And, is it a tax? Is it a quack, quack, quack? And that part, by the way, is only going to hit about 1% of Americans, and it's like $600 a year. No big deal, as Carrie Lucas pointed out. But I have said in the past that I think that the most important piece of Obamacare is that in a couple of years, it opens up the possibility of states like Vermont has already done, and they're just waiting, to set up their own single-payer healthcare system the way that Saskatchewan did, which will be ultimately the death of for-profit insurance in this country and is why the Republicans are working to repeal Obamacare, in my humble opinion. But the other thing that's really important about Obamacare is that it disconnects your health insurance from your employer, which means that the, depending on which survey you're looking at, 15 to 45% of Americans who stay with the job that they have, not because they love the job, they hate the job. They stay with the job that they have because they need the health insurance. It means that those people will feel free to go out on their own, start small businesses, become entrepreneurs. I mean, it's going to be an entrepreneurial boom, an explosion in America. In addition to that, over the past month, Chief Justice John Roberts apparently may have changed his mind on Obamacare. CBS News is reporting that Roberts initially sided with the conservatives on the court to strike down the entire thing, the whole Affordable Care Act. That's toast! And then he changed his mind and switched sides a few weeks ago to uphold the law, which was making the conservatives crazy, which is why they were, as Shana was telling us how, you know, he's a now a Supreme Court reporter with Talk Radio News Service and got all his credentials and badges and fancy IDs and great pictures and gets to go sit in the Supreme Court. And he said, boy, you know, Alito and Scalia were just cranky. Well, now we know why. This was, you know, on what was it, Monday or Tuesday? Monday, Shana. According to CBS, Roberts kept a close eye on media coverage of his own court leading up to the decision. Which makes you wonder, is he watching Fox News, or is he watching MSNBC, or is he watching RT, or is he watching Free Speech TV, or is it, what's, you know? Anyhow, one source close to the court suggested that Roberts may have changed his vote to keep the court's reputation intact. Now, this may have been a leak literally from one of the other justices. So anyhow, this is being spun by the conservatives as a big loss, and let's energize the base. But ultimately, what Roberts did for conservatives was a huge favor, whether they realize it or not. Because by upholding Obamacare, Roberts kept in place a for-profit health insurance program that could have been overturned in a few years had the health care crisis in America continued without action. Now, let me just add to this and just digress here for a moment. I know that there is a fairly loud and fairly small contingent of progressives who were saying, we hope the Supreme Court knocks down Obamacare because then we get single-payer health insurance. Dream on. If the Supreme Court had knocked down Obamacare, then Vermont would be out of luck. Montana would be out of luck. And I'm telling you, they're going to be the wedge that pops this whole thing open. And more importantly, tens of millions of Americans with pre-existing conditions or kids or, you know, poor people, people who work for Walmart and are making so little that they qualify for Medicaid, all those people would have been screwed. And that would have been the consequence of knocking down Obamacare. It wouldn't have caused us to instantly have national health care or single payer. It's not going to come about that way. It's not going to come about that fast. It's going to come about, and Bernie Sanders has told you this repeatedly on this program, over the 7 or 8 years that he's been doing this program every Friday, he has repeatedly said, and I absolutely agree with him on this, that putting into place a national single-payer health care program is going to be so difficult as to be impossible. But if a state can do it, it will become contagious. It will flow across America. But back to the politics of this, most importantly, by designating the individual mandate as a tax, Roberts gave Republicans a chance to repeal Obamacare through what's called reconciliation. Reconciliation is the way that the Senate deals with bills, legislation that has to do with money rather than laws, meaning the Republicans only need a simple majority in the Senate to get rid of the law. No filibuster allowed. This is a point that I made last week. As I said earlier, I've been talking about this for some time. And sure enough, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was apparently listening on Friday when I was making that point. Here's what he had to say on Fox News Sunday. Clip one, I think, Shane, is... No, it's not. Oh, it's number three that he talks about reconciliation.
The Chief Justice said it's a tax. Taxes are clearly what we call reconcilable. That's the kind of measure that can be pursued with 51 votes in the Senate. And if I'm the leader of the majority... next year, I commit to the American people that the repeal of Obamacare will be job one.
You notice how he goes, this is my... They had been holding that close to their vest. On my TV show on Friday afternoon, I had one of the more senior people at the Heritage Foundation on. And the last question was about Obamacare and, you know, what's going to happen. And he said his thing, and the other conservatives said his thing, and I said, I think that Justice Roberts gave the Republicans a big gift because now they can knock this down with 51 votes through reconciliation. And the guy from the Heritage Foundation started nodding and smiling, and I'm going, yeah, they're talking about this in the back rooms. They're just not saying it out loud. And that's why McConnell had to clear his throat to say that, because up until that point, no Republican had said it out loud. But I had been saying it, and I'm guessing that there are other progressives who were saying it, although I haven't heard any or seen any Friday or over the weekend, but I don't see how they could have missed it. So I think they just decided that they had to come out with it. So as much as President Obama hoped that the Supreme Court's ruling last week would just put an end to the debate, it's only just reignited it. Multimillionaire lobbyist Dick Armey's Tea Party, AstroTurf, Koch brothers-funded group FreedomWorks has already laid out a strategy to repeal Obamacare. It begins at the state level. They've got this on their website over at FreedomWorks. It's a five-point strategy to repeal Obamacare. Starts at the state level. Step one being preventing states from setting up Obamacare exchanges. These exchanges are critical to Obamacare as they open up free markets where people can buy health insurance plans at lower costs, much like members of Congress do, and can't be denied insurance for pre-existing conditions. So far, only two states have health insurance exchanges running, and one of them is Massachusetts, Mitt Romney's state, while 29 states have nothing. And Republican governors in five states, Florida, Kansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin, have already said they're going to refuse to set up a free market health insurance exchange. Step two, prevent states from expanding Medicaid coverage for low-income people. Under Obamacare, states are given a huge amount of money to give free money, basically federal money, to expand Medicaid coverage to individuals making up to 133% above the poverty line, around $40,000 a year for a family of four. If you make that amount or less, it means your health insurance is going to be free, unless your Republican governor turns down the money. So if states decide to turn down the free money for political reasons, that could limit how many Americans get free health insurance thanks to Obamacare. And as I said, governors in five states, again, including Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nevada, and South Carolina, have said, nah, we're not going to take the money. The more states that follow, the less effective Obamacare becomes. Steps 3, 4, and 5 to repealing Obamacare, according to the Koch brothers-funded FreedomWorks, all deal with the November election. Step 3, 4 more Republicans in the Senate so they can get this thing through with reconciliation of 51 votes. So they can use reconciliation to repeal Obamacare with 51 votes. Step number 4 is to retain the House Republican majority, which is likely because corporate and billionaire-funded super PACs are going to spend hundreds of millions to defeat progressives. And step 5, defeat President Obama. And thanks to Citizens United, for the first time in American history, an incumbent president is going to be out-fundraised in his re-election efforts. So, you know, who knows? But so what all this tells us is not only is the fight over Obamacare just beginning, it's going to get crazy. But because John Roberts declared it a tax which can't be filibustered in the Senate, Republicans have a fairly decent shot at repealing it. So keep your eyes on this one. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do you tell your friends, and particularly over the 4th of July weekend and holiday, your relatives or whatever, yeah, there's something good to this? Wow, that is great. What is that? Repeal the Blues. I love it. I love it. Yes, indeed. Repealable. It sounds like a plan. Okay, the only states that have exchanges up and running are Massachusetts and Utah. Utah? Where all the Mormons are? Massachusetts? Where Mitt Romney put it into place with RomneyCare? Am I seeing a conspiracy to make the Republicans crazy? I don't know. California, Colorado, Connecticut, Hawaii, they're all working on it. Maryland, Michigan, Nevada, New York, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, West Virginia. They're all putting these things together. But five states that have crazy Republican governors have said, nah, they're going to let the poor people and working people who are earning under $40,000 a year and can't afford to buy health insurance, they're just going to let them die. I'm not exaggerating. This is essentially what Nikki Haley said today. Families earning under $40,000 a year in South Carolina who can't afford to buy health insurance, sorry, We're not going to provide you with Medicare. We're not going to, or Medicaid rather. We're not going to take matching funds. We're not going to, it's 100% actually. We're not going to take free money from the federal government that we don't even have to match with a penny. Because it's more important to defeat President Obama in November than for you and your kids to be well. This is what Nikki Haley came out and said, in effect. This is what Scott Walker came out and said, in effect. Just pick your state, right? It's just, sometimes I'm speechless. I'm just so astounded by this. Ah, amazing. Bob in Northville, Michigan. Hey, Bob, it says you want to disagree with me. What's up?
Yeah, I just want to disagree with your fantasy that the Republicans, after eliminating, Obamacare, would give us something similar. I think that, gives people a false sense of hope and maybe encourages people that not to vote even.
You may well be right that they would simply throw us back into the system that we had. But suspicion is that after a couple of years of being able to have your kids on the plan and not have to deal with rescissions and pre-existing conditions and things, it's awful hard to walk this stuff back. I mean, the Republicans campaigned in 1940 and in 44 and in 48, they campaigned on repealing Social Security, and it hurt them badly. And which is why in 52, Eisenhower would not campaign on the platform of repealing Social Security.
I mean, Obamacare is basically just regulations on insurance companies that force them to be honest, take people with pre-existing conditions. And Republicans are against regulating insurance companies, banks, polluters. That's their mantra.
Right.
No regulation, period.
You're right. Okay. And we need to be making the point over and over again that if the Republicans repeal this, in all probability they won't replace it. You're right. Yeah. Bob, I stand corrected.
All right. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you. It doesn't happen often, but it does. Mark Taylor Canfield with Occupy Seattle. Hey, today is the first day of the big national Occupy hoop-de-doop in Philadelphia, right? Mark?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Oh, I'm not the Occupy Mark. I'm just Mark.
Oh, you're another Mark. Oh, okay. Sorry about that. It says Occupy Seattle on it.
Before I make the point I was calling in about, you had a gentleman just on from Mill Creek up the street wondering what he can do to get involved.
Uh-huh.
And one good thing he could do is in a few weeks he can take a drive down south and meet us all at the Progressive Conference that you're going to be attending. You're going to be showcasing yourself.
Yep.
And shoulder center down here in Kent. That's a good place for him to start.
Okay.
Another thing, too, Tom, is that you had a caller on a few segments ago, a woman conservative. And I just,
Mark, if you're on a speakerphone, can you take it off speakerphone? Because it's pretty hard to hear you. Thank you.
Okay.
There we go.
Is that better? Yeah.
Yes, much better.
So okay,
you were saying,
you're
talking about my conversation with Kerry Lucas.
Yes, and I just couldn't believe that was real. And they obviously, she doesn't understand or doesn't care to understand that because of the Affordable Care Act, that being a woman will no longer be a pre-existing condition.
Well, Kerry is a smart person, and she's fairly high up in the Republican or the conservative media system hierarchy. And I think that she does understand that. Actually, she's not here to defend herself, so let's just leave it at that.
Understood.
So.
And it just seems to me also that you put a lot of pieces together for what I thought Justice Roberts was doing. I know he didn't find a moral compass, or he's not worried about his legacy. Yeah. But with what you were talking about, setting it up for a reconciliation. Now, if President Obama gets reelected, if I'm not mistaken, he has to sign that repeal under reconciliation, wouldn't he?
I don't know. I thought that the Republican, that the president could refuse to sign anything and could even veto anything. I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I've never, Shano doesn't know either. We're looking. But I don't think that there's anything that the president can't refuse to sign. I will correct myself if I'm wrong, Mark, but within the next 5 minutes. But as far as I know, that's the case. Nancy in Albuquerque. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hey, thank you for your radio show. I listen to it a lot.
You're welcome. Your point?
Why I called was when the justice upheld the law under the taxing authority of Congress. I don't recall him actually calling it a tax, that it was constitutional under the taxing authority. Well, the taxing authority of Congress, which I don't see why this can't be considered a penalty, because they talk about the IRS.
Well, John Roberts, in his majority decision, said that it's both. And he said the way that he determined that it was a tax was the old, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck no matter what you call it. And he said this is enforced by the Internal Revenue Service, and it is, and that's the taxing agency of the government. And it involves money, and it involves money that can be taken out of your paycheck, you know, $600 a year if you don't pay it. And so, or at least they could be taken out of a Social Security check or something like that. And so, therefore, technically, it is a tax, according to John Roberts. And I think he's right. I think he's right. I think the argument should have been made right from the get-go that it was legal under taxing authority. But then they wouldn't have gotten Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu and Blanche Lincoln on board. So that's why they did it the way they did. Nancy, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, the Affordable Care Act, where do we go next? Interesting take on that right here. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very synchronously ugly. The good. The D.C. Republican Committee. The committee has included a call for LGBT equality in its official party platform. The platform reads, "We, the Republicans of the District of Columbia, support the belief that all individuals without regard to sexual orientation are entitled to full and equal protection under the laws and the Constitution, and that everyone has the right to be treated with dignity and respect." End quote. The statement is in stark contrast to other states' Republican Party platforms, like in Texas, where the platform argues that, quote, "homosexuality tears at the fabric of society and contributes to the breakdown of the family unit," end quote. Hopefully the D.C. Republicans can convince some of their other party members to jump on board and support equal rights for all. The bad. Shell. Last week, the Obama administration gave the green light to oil companies like Shell to start oil drilling in the Arctic. But if the company causes an oil spill, it has no idea what to do about it. When asked about the possibility of an oil spill in the Arctic, Shell said that their plan would be to, quote, encounter, end quote, 95% of the oil in open water before it could wash ashore. But they have no plan on how to actually collect and control the oil spill once they encounter it. In fact, a spokesman for Shell said, quote, "We never make claims about the percent we could actually recover because conditions vary, of course," end quote. You'd think Shell would have come up with methods to prevent or at least control oil spills, especially since the Gulf disaster, but they clearly haven't. And the very, very ugly Mike Malzone. Since the Supreme Court's ruling on Obamacare last Thursday, conservatives across the nation have weighed in on the decision. That includes Mike Malzone, the founder of the Merrimack Tea Party in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Malzone posted his take on the decision on Facebook Thursday, saying, "I hope the five Supremes get colon cancer." Of course, he's referring specifically to the five justices who upheld the law. Mr. Malzone could have simply said he disagreed with the decision, but instead he chose to wish a terrible disease on the justices who made it. This is the type of rhetoric that is all too common in politics today, and it is very, very ugly. Wee doggies, that's ugly. Where's Buddy? What was Buddy's last name? Buddy Ebsen, when you need him. He's passed along to gone to that great hillbilly home in the sky. But nonetheless, Daryl in Sanford, Florida. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, I'm just calling you to say hello, and I appreciate you so very much. But I was just wondering, why is it that the United States is the only country on planet Earth that has to make mega profits off its own citizens being sick?
Because we're the only country on Earth where the high court of the land has ruled that corporations are people and that the money that billionaires have is speech.
So how will we go about changing that?
We modify the Constitution so that they can no longer find that magical stuff in the Constitution, even though I don't think it's there, but they think it's there. So we amend the Constitution. If you go to movetoamend.org, you'll see a very simple amendment which says corporations are not people, money is not speech, end of discussion, shuts down the Supreme Court, who has been shoving this stuff down our throat for over 100 years, shuts them down, and takes us, and then that establishes a constitutional basis for Congress to pass laws like McCain-Feingold, or even far more restrictive than McCain-Feingold, put us in like with other countries where, for example, you can't do polling within 60 days of an election, and or at least you can't publish the results, or you know things like that that don't restrict the ability of a candidate to speak, but do restrict the ability of fat cats to change the outcome of elections. Or that, you know, third parties can't put money into campaigns. It has to be the candidate's money or the candidate's campaign, rather, and there are specific limits on how much people can give, and they have to declare their gifts. And, you know, all those things would become legal once again if we simply amended the Constitution. So, Daryl, thank you for the call. Thanks for raising the issue. That's how I would go about it. That's what I would do. Al in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Al, what's up?
Yeah, with regards to the Supreme Court decision, the integrity of the court is severely damaged by the fact that Kagan did not recuse herself. While she was part of the administration, she spearheaded Obamacare.
No, she didn't. No, she didn't. She had nothing to do with Obamacare. You have been listening to some right-winger who has been hallucinating. I guarantee you, Elena Kagan had nothing to do with Obamacare as her job as Solicitor General. Her job as Solicitor General was to argue cases in front of the Supreme Court. That's all she did. She wasn't a policy advisor. She didn't develop anything that had to do with health care. And most of what she was, you know, arguing in front of the Supreme Court was stuff like, you know, Guantanamo. She did not argue. She actually recused herself, you know, last week in another case that she had been involved with. I forget which one it was. What was it, Shana? The Arizona case, right? Because she had argued on behalf of the administration before the Supreme Court with regard to immigration law. So she recused herself in the Arizona case, even though she hadn't been involved directly in the Arizona case. She was close to it, so she recused herself. But she had never had anything to do with health care. I'm really sorry, Al, that you've been listening to right-wing radio there on, you know, probably your channel surfing on Sirius. I get it. It's easy to do. But and you have my sincere empathy. But no. Elena Kagan had nothing to do with Obamacare. It was not part of that office, period. Kay in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kay, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm a big fan. I read your book, I can't think of the name now, where you talk about personhood and stuff.
Yeah, Unequal Protection is the book.
Yeah, because I got a bunch of your books. But, you know, look, my husband's retired military, and I'm on disability. So I have Medicare and TRICARE, two, single-payer health care plan.
Right.
Everybody takes them. I don't pay a dime because I have the two, you know, and I don't know what people are getting all crazy about. You know, what I know is my son is 28 years old, bipolar, high blood pressure, and asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And my governor, Corbett, decides to mess around with adult basic.
Wow.
You know, like, you and I heard someone recently, this man saying his solution to the health care crisis was that people paid out of pocket for every service they receive as they receive it. I was stunned.
Right. Well, this is the, you know, the question that was asked of Ron Paul is, you know, okay, if we're not going to take care of each other, then what's your solution? And somebody in the audience yelled, you know, let him die, this 30-year-old healthy guy who got hit by a truck or something. And Ron Paul, you know, really didn't have an answer to the question. He was, you know, well, back in the old days, I used to take chickens when I was a doctor. Sorry, this ain't the old days.
I mean, Tom, I grew up in the military. I mean, I was born on the base. Oh. And right now, three of our grandkids just joined the Air Force. So, you know, heavily involved. And the other day, my husband and I were talking, and I said, I am increasingly feeling like my country is being taken from me. And I know both sides say that, but I feel this supreme sadness. Not so sad that I'm not going to raise hell, because that's what I do. But it's like, where has our humanity gone?
Yeah. Well, you get people who are followers of Ayn Rand, who was, you know, clearly a sociopath. and who ironically in her old age, when she turned 65, she signed up for Social Security and Medicare, and she got lung cancer from a lifetime of smoking, and she used Medicare to treat herself and, you know, got good treatment. I mean, ultimately it killed her, but she was just like, nobody should have access to any kind of government services ever under any conditions. That's like the Soviets. And that was her mantra. You know, Ronald Reagan made a record out of it. And, you know, back when he was campaigning against Medicare. And Medicare seems to work fairly well. Kay, one of the other things I find amazing, and you're a testimonial to this, is that there are so many people in the military who consider themselves conservatives and who are all, you know, Sturm und Drang about Obamacare. And yet the military is the most socialist institution in the United States of America. It not only provides your health care, it provides your housing, it provides your clothing, it provides your food, it provides your transportation. I mean, you don't get more socialist than the military.
Grow up, Tom. See, this is, I've seen, because I'm 55, I've seen the military change, and the thing that upsets me more than anything is the privatization of aspects of the military.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it really does, because that's nothing but making profit for other
people.
You're right.
People. It's, that, you, that's
you know,
all it is.
When I grew up, Tom, my parents didn't have to talk about paying rent and electricity and none of that. That was paid for.
Yep.
You know, and that's why it's like a whole different culture, you know, but I don't get it, because I went to a vets meeting, Shippensburg vets meeting, because my husband's going to college, mm-hmm. and we started talking about the suicide rate and all that kind of stuff, and that it's a 30 to 80 day wait for someone. It, once they ask for help, to actually get help.
Yeah, it's because Congress has been underfunding some of these programs, which is a crime in and of itself.
I mean, Tom, you know the culture in the military in and of itself. I mean, first off, to get to the point where you're going to ask for help is major.
Right, right.
And then it makes me angry to the core.
Yeah.
Because when you put people in war, and these people didn't look at it. You put them on repeated tours, and you're wondering why that guy shot his commander at Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
You're wondering why this stuff has happened.
Well, this is these are the kind of decisions that get made by people like Bush and Cheney, who, you know, Bush went AWOL his last year in the Army National Guard or Air, whatever it was, you know, the Champaign unit out of Texas, and Cheney got 5 deferments, and these guys were making policy for the military, and I don't think that they understood what multiple deployments means, particularly for people who didn't even sign up for a war, who didn't think they were when they were joining, for example, the National Guard. Okay, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what do you say on the 4th of July to your crazy brother-in-law? There's some really interesting advice over at Crooks and Liars I want to share with you after the break. Okay, so what do you, as promised, what do you say to your crazy brother-in-law when you're at dinner on 4th of July, or you're sitting there at the cookout and you got tofu dogs on the grill or whatever, and the topics come up? This is over from Crooks and Liars. In fact, let me see who posted this here so I can give appropriate credit. Susie Madnack. I hope I'm not mangling her name. And she's got a clip that we can't play on the air. Of Eddie Murphy talking about, you know, crazy relatives around Thanksgiving. But so she says, you know, if you're like most people, you have a couple of wing nuts in your family. So what do when these things come up? If the Affordable Care Act comes up and they start talking about $500 billion cut in Medicare and death panels, then she says, look at him, snap your fingers and say cheerily, that reminds me. Personally, I think the freedom for people to have health insurance that isn't connected to their jobs is going to set off a wave of national entrepreneurship and small businesses, which are going to be great for the economy and bring real innovation back. It's going to be great, don't you think? Plus, we'll be able to compete with other countries that already provide universal health care, so our jobs won't be going overseas. I thought you'd be happy. So that's the Obamacare one. The Kenyan one, this... She says, this is so silly, it's absurd. She says, You know, I've been wondering about those stories that Mitt Romney was born to a polygamous family in Mexico. Sometimes I'm convinced, and other times I think it can't be true. What do you think? Maybe. Okay. The voter fraud one I thought was hysterical. When they go off about, you know, they've been watching Fox News, so they're all up to date on Acorn and voter fraud and all the, you know, it's a conspiracy, don't you know? You say, yeah, it took me a while to get over the Bush family and the Supreme Court stealing the 2000 election, but look at me now. In other words, get over it. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Bonnie in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I've got a question and a request, Tom.
Okay.
Who named the Affordable Care Act Obamacare?
I don't know.
Well, my request is stop using Obamacare and please say the Affordable Care Act.
Well, Bonnie, I used to do that. I was pretty good about it. And then about, I don't know, must have been 3 months or so ago, I'm on everybody's mailing list, right? I get the emails from the RNC. I get them from the White House. I get them from the DNC. I get them from every place. And we got a press release in the White House referring to it as Obamacare. And I asked Victoria Jones about that on the air. I said, I got a press release from the White House, you know, or from the president's campaign, one or the other, you know, but something to do with President Obama, referring to this as Obamacare. Have they changed their policy? Because they always referred to it as the Affordable Care Act. And she said, yes, they have decided to embrace this. This is the president's enduring legacy. He's proud of it. And the White House now officially wants us to call it Obamacare. So I figured, what the heck, I'll call it Obamacare.
Well, I guess I can't say what I feel about the White House doing that, but I did watch Amy Goodman's show one day, and they talked about the whole health care issue, and they never said Obamacare one time, and it was so refreshing.
Well, that's the difference between Amy and me, and I really respect her for that. Amy is a reporter, and she's just giving you the facts.
It felt good, because Obamacare, to me, is a Republican word.
Well, it was.
I love what the president said in his speech when he said, I'm really happy that the people think that Obama cares.
Yes, that's sweet. That's sweet. And as I said, I Amy Goodman is brilliant. She is the heir to Walter Cronkite or this generation's Walter Cronkite. She is just doing the facts.
But if the White House wants you to keep using it, and the president wants you to keep using it, then.
But I'm just a talk show host here, just a political commentator, and as political commentary, I'm perfectly happy to use it. Bonnie, thank you for the call, and thanks for your kind comments. Fred in New Bedford, Mass. Hey, Fred, what's up?
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
The reason I was calling was, you know, there's already a mandate in which the Republicans really support. It's the hospital mandate. I mean,
yeah, it was passed by Reagan. You know,
exactly. I mean, you know, hospitals are mandated to treat people when they go in from an accident, and they have to treat people. So why would they be against an individual mandate, but yet support a mandate that's on private business such as hospitals?
Well, here's another mandate that the Republicans support. They support the mandate that if a woman wants to get an abortion, she has to get an ultrasound.
Right.
I mean, exactly. You know, there's no, and you know, whether you like that or not, and whatever your position on abortion may be, what it does point out is that there's no intellectual or philosophical integrity to the Republicans' argument. They used to be in favor of what we call Obamacare. It was originally the Heritage Foundation's strategy as to oppose Hillary Care, which was largely a big national public option in a pool, basically, with all the health insurance companies, and they'd have to compete against the government. And so the Heritage Foundation tried to come up with a way where they wouldn't compete against the government, and that was adopted by Mitt Romney. I mean, this was originally a conservative idea, then it became a Republican idea, and then it became the Democratic idea. And
you know, they should be hit over the head with this. You know, every time, you know, they come up, these conservative pundits, and say, look, you already support a mandate. Yeah. And also, so what are you suggesting, that hospitals not treat people if they go in?
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't support a mandate for an individual, how can you support a mandate for a private business, which you supposedly, are supporting?
Yeah. But there's the bottom line is that there is no intellectual integrity in this argument on the right at all. It is as soon as it becomes something that a Democratic president is doing, they're opposed to it. It's totally knee-jerk. It has nothing to do with logic or rationality. And I hope that, as I did today when I was debating Kerry Lucas, I hope that commentators will start referring to this as the Heritage Foundation Romney-Obama plan whenever they have a conservative on who wants to take it apart. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, what to expect when you're electing. Strategists Eric Burns and Carl Frisch discuss what's next in presidential campaign politics. Plus, now that the dust is settling, a closer look at last week's SCOTUS ruling and the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.